And now time for the opinion page. There's a new kind of labor movement in the United States led by those who are not in unions, primarily retail and fast food workers. These workers are protesting before they unionize, and in a column for the Chicago Tribune, columnist Clarence Page compares this new labor movement to Occupy Wall Street. If you work in the fast food industry or if you own a fast food franchise, what would a change in the minimum wage law mean for you? 800-989-8255 is our phone number. Email us talk@npr.org. Clarence Page is a syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune and joins us here in Studio 42. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. Welcome to the new studio.
Thank you, Neil. Great to be here.
And you talk about the wage discrepancies that we've seen so much, and that is because a lot of the jobs that poorer people have are in retail operations, particularly in operations like fast food.
Well, that's right. Folks we deal with every day when we go to get our cheeseburgers or whatever, our minimum wage workers at a time when being a minimum wage worker doesn't put you on that starting ladder to upward mobility the way it used to.
It's not the engine to the middle class.
Not like it used to be way back when I was one in my youth, you know, and could work my way through college with the jobs I picked up in the summer or part-time. You know, those tuitions are a lot higher now. The industrial jobs I was able to have access to have dried up. And we really haven't talked enough about this, but this income gap is a very real thing. And I know it's not chic to say anything nice about unions in this this day and age, but I said, what the heck? You know, you talk to folks who are out there trying to, you know, a lot of them are single moms supporting kids and this sort of thing. And I think it takes a lot of courage for them really to take a stand.
And you're talking about a movement of a sort organized mm-hmm. by a union offshoot, an offshoot of the SEIU,
yeah.
but is trying to organize protest before they organize unions.
Yeah, as you know, SEIU was an offshoot from the AFL-CIO and all because they thought there was too much time spent doing things besides organizing. So now this Change to Win campaign is an offshoot of that. That is even more into getting people to organize and advocate for themselves. And this is really how organized labor got started. You know, before there were unions, there were people who protested their working conditions and their wages. And so it's become almost impossible to form a union these days with the way the federal law has turned. And so there's kind of this new movement afoot. And I compare it to Occupy because, for one thing, some of the folks I talked to were out there on the Occupy demonstration line, too. And a lot of that spirit is living here where you see a protest.
Well, how's it manifesting itself?
Well, it's been what we used to call wildcat walkouts. I mean, there are strikes, one-day strikes in cities like Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York, Milwaukee, St. Louis, Detroit, Seattle. In D.C., which I focused on, it's taken a turn of pushing for President Obama to, by executive order, raise the wages of anybody who contracts with the government and in government buildings, which, as you know, in D.C., Union Station, the Smithsonian, Reagan Building, a lot of these government buildings have fast food franchises in them.
And you wrote about in your piece a woman who works at a fast food franchise at the very popular Smithsonian Air and Space Museum.
Right, and she testified before Congress as well, Melissa Roseborough, and she's one of those cases of a single mom, a grandmom, actually, who has been working at the McDonald's there. And she walked out with other workers and did testify before Congress and talking about what can be done for minimum wage workers in government buildings in particular. She ran into some heat from her boss, but the other workers stood up with her. She's not the only case where that's happened. Managers and owners are raising wages on their own because, for one thing, it helps to reduce turnover to have happy workers.
Again, in your piece, you talk about one of those executives, head of Costco. I think,
that's right.
Who's saying we ought to be paying not 8.25, but what, 10.68?
That's right. Craig Jelinek at Costco, in order to have a competitive advantage, and they pay $11.50. In fact, at Costco is their starting wage, and he's very much a believer in saving money through reducing turnover rather than cutting wages. And I think he's a good role model for a lot of other bosses and owners. Because, you know, this today we have seen since 1960, really, the real new class structure in America is those who have some education beyond high school and those who don't. There has been no real increase in wages, considering inflation, since that time. And in fact, in recent years, low-wage workers have slipped back. And it's really, like I say, one of those hidden issues. You know, I mean, the civil rights movement, you talk about race and people get up and take to the streets, they get a lot of support. You talk about class and Americans get real itchy and run and hide. I don't know why that is, Neil, but I think that's why I said, well I'm going to stand out and step out and stand up for these folks. And I think more people should too.
We'll get to calls in just a minute. We particularly want to hear from those of you in the fast food industry, whichever part of the industry you're in. Would a change in the minimum wage, how would that change things? 800-989-8255, email us, talk@npr.org. But Clarence, as you well know, there are plenty of people who say, wait a minute, if you raise the minimum wage, you're going to have fewer jobs. So it's going to cost poor people. It's not going to help them.
That's the debate. And in fact, if you look, well, there's two kinds of wages or two kinds of minimum wage. There's the statutory minimum wage by law, and there's the real minimum wage, which is what will the market bear. When you're having a real prosperous economy like we had in the late 90s, a lot of employers, and most of them, were paying more than the minimum wage because they needed to get workers to flip hamburgers or whatever else. Some were even, I remember in Boston, shuttle buses being run to low-income areas to get young kids to work at the McDonald's and the other franchises out in the more affluent suburbs or communities. This is what the theory is based on. But in fact, a number of studies, I cited one in my column, which have found that when you consider the reduced turnover, which is a very expensive proposition for employers.
Because you have to bring in new people and train them.
That's right. That you really save money in the long run by paying a higher minimum wage. So the debate goes on. But I think realistically, we do have, if you look overall at the situation here in America, we do have a widening gap between low-income workers and upper income. And this is one way to relieve it.
As so often in the past, Clarence Page is with a syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Let's see if we get a caller in on the conversation, and we'll start with Peter. Peter with us from Sioux Falls in South Dakota.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
As your guest mentioned, the idea of different companies paying a higher wage, I think that's definitely the way to go. Sorry, let me back up. I've worked in fast food and in kitchens basically for just under a decade, and so I've been working kind of right around that minimum wage and above. But as you labeled this the opinion page, well, here comes my opinion. How would it affect me if the minimum wage were raised? Quite frankly, I see not at all. Because if every company has to pay slightly higher for those that are paying at minimum wage, that's going to affect their bottom line, and so they're going to pass that cost on to their customers. Well, their customers then are going to complain that their cost of living has gone up. They go to their employers, so on and so forth, and all we just get up is just more inflation, which I understand is necessary to make investments work, but really I'm going to end up right back where I started. Sure, my paychecks are bigger, but I'm spending a lot more money on things that I buy when I go places. I think really the way to do it, like your guest mentioned, is the individual, you know, case-by-case basis, individual companies taking the initiative. I mean, so long as they're not, you know, passing on the cost, which I understand, but if they truly view it as a savings in preventing the turnover and are saving the money that way, why not? More power to them. On a government-wide level, I think, is not the way to go.
So, Clarence, you're clearly talking about inflation here.
Yeah, that's the debate, as I say. But what we have found, I mean, just by experience, I don't even need to have a PhD in economics to see that, for one thing, the burger franchises, for example, they keep making them cheaper when they want to, you know, to increase sales. And we find that, I mentioned the Costco example, which the New York Times report called the anti-Walmart, because while a lot of controversies, and it was a big walkout by Walmart, workers last year that made news. Costco that hasn't had that problem. And so I think if you look at different companies who are able to remain competitive and the customers still keep flowing in, because when people want to buy something, they're going to find ways to do it. And that we have not had an inflation problem, as the Fed tells us. So I think the usual theories seem to fall by the wayside quite often when it comes to supply and demand and this sort of thing.
Peter, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
And I wanted to ask you, we'll get to another call in just a minute, but you talked about protest before unionization and the barriers we know to unionization. Are these people going to be able to have an effective representation a la a union to benefit from these wildcat strikes?
Now, that's the hope of SEIU and other unions that are involved with assisting this movement. They are hoping that once people begin to – I mean, I talked to organizers and saw them at work, you know, going out and talking to fast food workers. And their first question is, would you like to make more money?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who wouldn't, right?
Right.
And so not everybody's going to listen to you, but there are others who step up and say, hey, I've got, you know, three kids at home and blah, 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 and I'm desperate. And those are the folks who are the beginning of your movement. And you start to see more and more of that. And then you have a walkout. Everybody doesn't walk out, but enough do that they feel more solidarity. And then in some cases, you've had employers who say, well, don't bother coming back. But then everybody comes back in the next day, and the employer sees the light and says, well, okay, we'll give you another chance. Mm-hmm. I mean,
because then he doesn't have to train a whole new cohort of workers.
Well, exactly. You know, and so this is how it starts. Now, once you get enough successes, then people start to talk about developing an infrastructure, meaning form real organizations, which we call unions. And that's what a lot of these organizers are hoping. I think that's the real long-term thrust of the movement, to try to revive the union movement through this method.
Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Dale is on the line with us from Columbus.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Okay, I'm 61. I'm in good shape. I spent a lifetime from 15 years old at 90 cents an hour in restaurants. I made it a point to become an executive chef of a 500-seat restaurant here in Columbus. And my wife was my pastry chef, as a matter of fact. And we went through a series of jobs, and we decided that it was time to watch our tweens because we were working a lot of hours. And we went to a family restaurant. We planned on opening a restaurant of our own. And, of course, as soon as I bought this house across the street and 2 doors down, Faith stepped in and said, no, you have breast cancer. So we lost half our income. 2.5 years later, I lost her. 2 years later, I lost my job because the restaurant closed. And then I lost my house. And the bottom line is this, everything is fast food today. I'm a dishwasher right now. I'm a dishwasher at a gourmet Mexican restaurant, and it's all fast food. And the bottom line is I make just above minimum wage, and it's like when they want you, you work 14 hours a day nonstop. And when they don't want you, after 3 hours, they send you home. And I work with Latinos who, by the way, during the election, I had them chanting, Obama, Obama. And as it turns out, there's nowhere to go. Corporations have taken over food service. There's no question about it. Everything is minimum wage. Everything is fast food. And you're talking to a guy who served former presidents, former governors, former mayors, fine dining, $350 a meal entities for, you know, charities and stuff, the American Red Cross and things. Met two presidents, and I got a letter from the president after getting one back where I whined about my life and said, hey, here's what you need to do. Be cool, be safe, because you're going to be challenged every step. And I understand the politics of life, but I'm nowhere. My wife's Social Security pays my rent. I lost my house. I'm in a one-bedroom apartment. I'm barely getting by. And I ran a 550-seat restaurant.
Mm. Given the number of kids, Dale, that go into culinary school these days, would you encourage them?
My kids are growing up.
All right. Dale, thanks very much for the call. We wish you better luck.
Sure. Me too.
Thank you.
As a fellow Ohioan, I sympathize. I mean, I grew up in, you know, we talked about this before, how much more difficult it is now to afford college. You know, I worked in the steel mill there in Middletown, Ohio at a time when tuition to Ohio U was $770 for the, and this was in the mid-60s. And, you know, the steel mill jobs aren't there anymore like they used to be. And college tuition, as you know, is 10 times higher than it used to be. There is a real difficulty now in moving upward in that classic American dream fashion. And Ohio is one of those post-industrial states, if you will, where that's happening.
Do you fear that this is going to become a permanent stratification, that people will be trapped for a lifetime in these kinds of service jobs?
I don't see a turnaround. I mean, there's always opportunities to move up if you work hard enough, you know, take a community college or some other route or whatever. But we see the numbers just going up and up. And, you know, even now in the immigration debate, it is apparent that while immigration has helped our economy and helped America in the long run, it's creating more competition for low-wage jobs. And so that tends to depress low-wage income even more or prevent it from rising in value. So I don't see any real turnaround right now unless we consciously start talking about this in an honest way.
Clarence, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
It'll be interesting to see that vote on the border surge later today.
That's right.
In the Senate, to see whether that immigration bill is going to get the 70 votes that Lindsey Graham and other people were talking about.
That's right.
Yeah, interesting. Clarence Page joined us here in Studio 42. Tomorrow, a look ahead at the future of medicine with Doctors Sherwin Newland and Atul Gawande. Join us for that. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.